There is a metaphor sometimes used to explain the wet spring weather in the Pacific Northwest. People say it rained like a fire hose. So what happens when there is a kink?
Because if you have 10,000 pounds of milk that are in a tanker that's picked up milk on the farm, like what you see going down the road, you can't just back that up to a food bank and say, here you go, here's your milk, or back it up to some family's home.
As the American food supply faces an existential threat, can lessons be learned during the coronavirus pandemic that forever alter how food winds up on our table? Today, a conversation with COIN digital reporter Hannah Ray Lambert about our work looking into why the pandemic isn't causing problems with the food supply system, it is highlighting them. It is Thursday, May 21st, and I'm Ian Costello. You are listening to the COIN Podcast Network coverage of the coronavirus pandemic.
From our studios in downtown Portland, Oregon, this is a COIN 6 digital exclusive.
All right, Hannah Ray, you and I have been working on this story for at least a month. How many people have you talked to for this?
Just the ones that are going into this, four that are just in here, and then other ones that didn't make it in here.
And I've talked to three people to help me understand what is actually going on here. One of them will be featured prominently in our discussion, Dr. Xiaowei Wu. He's a professor at Oregon State, and he literally wrote a book on food supply chain management. Do you think the average consumer understands what it takes to get goods, whatever they may be, and we're generally talking about food in our discussion, from a manufacturer or producer to their homes?
We know farms, we know ranching, and we know retail, but most people miss the middle part. So that is a meat packing, a slaughterhouse, and the secondary processing, and the refrigeration, and distribution. So those are the parts that we as regular consumers do not think much about.
So to fully understand the threat to the food supply in the United States that comes with this coronavirus pandemic, we need to accept that the structure of the system that keeps us fed and food manufacturers in business is not one chain, but many. It's not one metaphorical teeter-totter maintaining balance between supply and demand, but rather a dusty playground full of hundreds of them. It's not one balance beam stretched between the farmer and the consumer, but thousands.
So since the onset of the pandemic here, there's been this growing concern over the health of the food chain. However, how it actually operates, I don't think a lot of people understand. It's not really a chain. It's not a beam. And it's not, you know, to your metaphor of a teeter-totter on a playground, it's not one worn down board stretched over a wrought iron bar. It's a bunch of them. So in operational reality, what we commonly refer to as the supply chain is actually much more like a complex structure made up of interconnected supply chains, a lot of interconnected supply chains that combine to keep the whole system of distribution sound. And that's something that came up several times in my conversation with Dr. Wu.
So really the thing to think about, this is not a supply chain, it's a food system.
So I guess think of it as a spider web. It's able to withstand a variety of issues with one or two of the strands or chains at a time. But if you break too many at the same time, the results can be catastrophic. And this came up in my conversations with Tammy Kerr, who's the executive director of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association.
I have never experienced anything like this in my lifetime.
No industry better illustrates the optimal efficiency of the supply chain system in the United States when fully functional than agriculture. What we call agri-industry combines the markets for the grains, vegetables, and livestock that make up an overwhelming majority of what we eat.
Yeah, and that's the same industry that illustrates the fragility and fundamental flaws in the supply chain system when it is pressurized by a global emergency like we are dealing with right now with this pandemic.
We want the product at the right time, right place, and the right quantity. So that's the smooth flow of goods. And we think this for automotive production, computers, iPhones, and we think the same thing about food.
Any Econ 101 student should be able to tell you that the capitalist system relies on a balance. And it's not an overly delicate one, but there is a balance between supply and demand. So there's the people who are distributing the goods to those who demand it, and it has to come when they demand it. And as Dr. Wu explained, that doesn't work when something breaks.
And the system does not really work well if you think about the food, when you think about disruption.
We see that clear evidence along the timeline of the coronavirus pandemic of potentially critical damage done to both sides of the supply and demand equation. The teeter-totter tilted one way and then the other. So it's straining different lengths of that supply chain, or the strands of the web, to use that metaphor again, at the same time.
So here we are in late December, early January, and there's the beginning of the outbreaks of the coronavirus in China and Southeast Asia, and that hammered demand for American goods. Similar slowdowns occurred to both Canada and Mexico as the virus started to spread globally. And then as the first coronavirus cases showed up in the United States, we started to see these outbreaks of surge buying that shocked the market and unfairly tilted the demand for agri-products. Dr. Wu explained that pretty well when we talked.
Well, we buy, we hoard, and for the retailers, it's really hard for them to plan out their contracts, who they buy, how much they buy. And then from the producer, the same problem. They do not know what's a real demand.
So there was a situation where first a bunch of frozen meats and vegetables disappeared from the shelves, and then dairy, and then dry grains. And now, more recently, in the last few weeks, we're seeing these runs on pork and beef.
In the long run, what happened is that there will be a fluctuation of inventories in the system because we do not know exactly how much we should produce, or retailer, we do not know how much exactly is going to be sold.
By late March was really when we started to see the variety of stay-at-home orders implemented throughout the United States that then crashed the outside-the-home sort of institutional commercial consumer demand markets, like restaurants, schools, things like that. And those, according to the USDA, accounted for more than half of the food purchased in the United States in 2018.
And Hannah Ray, Dr. Wu built on that point to explain how the first problems we saw with the supply chain was actually on the demand side.
With the pandemic, and the demand from the institutional buyers, like universities, hotels, and restaurants, and schools are down. And they buy largely about 60% of the foods produced. Now the consumer buys 60% from the retail and from retailer groceries. So there's a demand problem.
Two clear examples of the problem we're talking about here come from the way we use cows.
Right. So within weeks of the first confirmed coronavirus cases in the United States, dairy products started to vanish from store shelves in a lot of places. Many other places saw a quick introduction of limits on purchases, so that buy one or two per family.
For the first time that I can remember in my lifetime in the United States, people were being told how much milk or dairy they could buy.
Right. And at the same time, we saw that news footage showing farmers intentionally dumping tens of thousands of gallons of milk down the drain. I asked Tammy Kerr of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association about that.
Food service sales, you know, have decreased, and a lot of milk is sold to schools. And with schools and restaurants being closed, you know, that also hurts.
So when the pandemic hit, commercial and institutional use of dairy that made up, according to what we've been able to find, that made up nearly half of the sales of all milk, cheese, and other dairy products, it just fell apart. And even while we saw the demand at the grocery store increase, it's really expensive and time consuming for a producer to change how their product is distributed. And that's something that came up in your discussion a couple times with Tammy Kerr.
That creates sudden changes in our supply chain. And some of the dairy processors have had to make cuts or change production schedules. And if you're scheduled to make certain products, it takes a little time to make those adjustments.
Hannah Ray, is there a different way to explain that? What is Tammy Kerr trying to say there?
So plants that ship milk by the tanker truck full, they don't have the equipment to distribute it in cartons to retail locations. So distributors that provided restaurants with like 50-pound bags of cheese, they didn't have the infrastructure to package it in 1 and 2 pound bags that you or I would buy at the grocery store. And that came up in my conversation with Tammy Kerr's Washington counterpart, Kimmy Devaney. She's the communications director for the Dairy Farmers of Washington.
Each processing plant generally has a certain purpose, right? So if there's a cheese plant, a milk plant, a butter plant, and a dry milk facility to create dry milk powder, the dry milk powder plant can't just pivot and become a cheese plant. Cheese plant can't just pivot and become a yogurt plant overnight. A pizza company may have a 50-pound bag of shredded cheese that they're usually using, so there's less of that. And people don't need a pallet of dry milk powder at their homes. They don't need a 50-pound bag of cheese at their homes as they're trying to get that milk redirected into the plants that package for retail, such as grocery stores. That's where you're seeing that backup of milk. So at a certain point, there's nowhere for it to go.
So here we are in the middle of April now, and the demand has changed. Commercial demand has plummeted and individual demand has increased, and the supply system hasn't been able to adjust. And this is creating a problem because, as we've heard from the two experts that you've talked to, there's nowhere for the milk to go, but the cows can't stop producing it.
Right. Everyone who has dairy cows knows they're not going to just wait around. You got to go out there at least every morning to milk those cows, or they're not going to be happy.
So that's one way that cows get used. And then for the cattle rancher, we've got another problem. And you talked to Jerome Rosa, who's the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, about that.
The concern now is cattle are starting to back up.
So Jerome Rosa and I talked kind of at the time we were starting to see those shutdowns at the meat plants across the country, but they were also dealing with plunging demand for certain cuts of beef as schools closed, as restaurant traffic slowed to a trickle. Much like the cheese example, the meat that is packaged for commercial use, like restaurants, tends to be pretty different than what is packaged as case ready for consumer purchases at grocery stores.
So if you look at meats, and we buy a lot of the customized small packaged meat, right? Case ready in the grocery store, the ground beef. But you look at the restaurants, they buy the premium pricier cuts, like a tenderloin. So for the even the facilities are open, they have to cut it to meet the home use. And so there's a glutton of supply of certain products we need, but we cannot have access, or that's in a form that's not coming to us.
As panic, surge, or that hoard buying unnaturally increased demand for consumer-level products at grocery stores, and then the collapse of the institutional markets drove down commercial demand, the demand side of the supply system equilibrium became dangerously unpredictable.
And then we get to the problem that really got everybody's attention when the coronavirus arrived in the packing plants across the country. We used to go on field trips when I was in elementary school, where we'd go to the dairy factory in the city near my town that I grew up in. And I've been inside meat packing plants. Anyone who has ever toured or even seen video from inside one of those major manufacturing plants, they can tell you that it's jammed, it's cramped, and those conditions are prevalent in a lot of factory settings. And those are conditions that aid and probably encourage the spread of the coronavirus among the employees. In my conversation with Dr. Wu, we talked about that as soon as there was coronavirus in the packing house, there was a serious problem with getting the product packaged.
And then as a result, there's a bottleneck and there's not enough packing facility. There's not enough packing capacity. So that's where we started getting in trouble.
So these cases start to hit in the packing plants, and things get so bad in one Smithfield pork plant in South Dakota that by mid-April, it was being referred to as a super spreading location. And officials there were saying it was responsible for a bulk of the overall coronavirus infections in the state. And then by the end of the month, we were seeing more than a dozen closures at major slaughterhouses in the United States that were forced to shutter because their employees were contracting and likely spreading the coronavirus in between employees at the plant and then their families at home. Some industry analysts were estimating that that wiped out as much as a quarter of the pork processing in the country.
Right. According to analysis done by the Food and Environment Reporting Network, by mid-May, more than 200 meat packing plants in the country were reporting cases of coronavirus. More than 14,000 meat workers had tested positive, and at least 57 have died. Plants really, they didn't have any choice but to close, at least temporarily. And even where they didn't, workers were heavily weighing their own safety against their financial well-being, what they were getting out of this job. And that came up in my conversations also with Jerome Rosa of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
You know, there's several reasons why these plants aren't able to process. You know, some of them are within this plant's control and some of it isn't. We've heard reports of workers that are just walking off of work and just hoping to get fired so that they can collect unemployment benefits. They got their stimulus checks and they're really kind of strong-arming the packers.
There will be a meat shortage because the factories are closed.
So as Jerome Rosa pointed out and Dr. Wu pointed out, the closures at meat plants create this bottleneck for getting meat from the ranch through the plant to the table. The slaughtering and processing of livestock slowed to a crawl, and these cattle ranchers that you've talked to and the pork and poultry farmers, they had a difficult choice. Try and wait it out and pay for the feed to care for animals for an unknown extended period of time, or to euthanize them.
And that's a hard choice for anyone, and it kind of varies on the size and scale of the operation if you even have enough space to keep all these extra animals. At some point, it starts becoming a concern for the well-being of the animals that you're keeping there because they're all crowded together. So while farmers and ranchers were making decisions to either dump dairy or kill cattle as early as late March, it took some of those big names to get the attention of the public at large.
By the first week of May or so, Kirkland, Washington-based Costco announced their plan to start limiting the amount of beef stores would allow customers to purchase. May 5th, we see these reports that some Wendy's restaurants in the United States, some of those reports said that 1 in 5 Wendy's restaurants were running out of beef. And then less than 2 weeks later, major grocery store chains began instituting limits on how much meat customers could buy.
Big names like Wendy's, Costco, Whole Foods, those make headlines. But the decreasing availability of meat creates a concern for the consumer that there's a supply problem.
And I asked Dr. Wu how long it's going to take before we start to see significant issues with supply on shelves.
6 weeks, I think there will be shortages. There will be shortages of food, of varieties.
So the United States produces slightly more than 10% of the world's food supply. We do it with less than 5% of the total world population. So that means we're the most efficient producer of food in the world. But that same efficiency puts us at a higher risk for failure when we're hit by violent shifts in the supply and demand equation.
That brings us to the point of why I went down the road on doing this story in the first place. Why are citizens of the world's best food producing country seeing empty store shelves and dealing with limit restrictions on the purchase of agricultural industry goods within 3 months of the onset of the pandemic? Being this efficient, we should be able to handle interruptions like this. And Dr. Wu really pointed me towards something I didn't know about the system. So few plants produce so much of the food, and that is the root of the problem.
So the problem here is that they control a significant portion of the meat processing. So the top four in the U.S., they process 50% of the pork and the poultry and 80% of the beef. So imagine 1, 2, or 3 facilities shut down, you have a high percentage of the shortages.
So the threat we're seeing to the food supply system is not just because the coronavirus showed up.
Right. It was sort of always lurking there in the background. When you have a small number of plants that control such a large percentage of the production, and then they're forced to close or significantly slow down thanks to the pandemic, it just highlights the inherent danger of a centralized system of getting perishable goods like produce or meat from those who supply it to those who want to eat it.
So we trace this problem back to when the United States agricultural industry was in kind of a near-death state in the mid-1980s, and the consolidation of the production that allowed major meat processors to come in, swoop up these smaller processors, and create mega plants and centralize the industry. And when you talk to Jerome Rosa from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, he kind of illustrated with two pretty simple numbers.
So there's four packers that control about 83% of all the beef in the United States.
So that was a surprise to me, learning that we have such a small number of packers controlling all of our meat supply, basically. The 50 biggest beef plants owned by a small handful of companies produce 98% of the beef. Mega plants that can house more than 1 million pigs at a time are responsible for 88% of the pork slaughtered in the United States. Similarly, you see disproportionate numbers that can be applied to the poultry industry, too.
So that centralized structure of food distribution, it makes the United States the most efficient producer in the world, as we talked about. But it also puts several strands of the food supply chain, this food supply web that we've been talking about, under tremendous strain when a pandemic hits just one packing plant. But now we see it hits not one, not two, but a dozen. This is something that is not being experienced by decentralized food systems like those in Europe. And Dr. Wu was very quick to point that out to me.
When you look at Europe, the top 12 accounts for less than 1/3 of the meat production. So it's very decentralized. So if you have a facility shut down, or two or three, it does not have much disruption as severe as in the US. Efficiency is not efficacy. So it's efficient, but at what cost? So this pandemic probably is the beginning of a lot of changes.
Despite how it feels right now, we know that this pandemic is not going to last forever, even though it feels like it at times. People will return to schools and restaurants and hopefully refrain from rushing to the grocery store to grab all the chicken wings or yeast or toilet paper. But the way we view food supply is undergoing a violent evolution.
And a lot of farmers are hopeful that it will make people, the consumers, more aware of where their food comes from and how many people are involved. This came up when I was talking with Beth Satterwhite, who owns Evenpole Farm. It's a very small farm located near McMinnville.
Take a second when you eat some food and like think about like who picked this? Where was it grown? Was that person treated well? Was that land treated well? Like this kind of stuff matters, and we just don't take the time in our normal, like insane modern lives. Like if there's ever been a time to like just pause for 1 second, like now is it. You have more time right now, or at least a lot of us do. So just take a second.
And in the long run, the way we produce, buy, and eat food will likely change too. As we were wrapping up our conversation, that's something that Dr. Wu wanted to make sure we all understood.
And so that really triggered a broader question is what do we need, how much meat we eat, and also how much we are willing to pay for food, for the labor across the supply chain, from retail workers to the processing plants. So, you know, yes, we're going to pay more, we'll value more, maybe we eat less.
That does it for Thursday, May 21st. Thank you for listening to the Coin Podcast Network. Take care of yourselves, stay safe, and we will talk to you soon.
The Coin 6 Podcast Network is your home for all sorts of content you can't find anywhere else. Visit coin.com/coinpodcast to see our entire library. And you can always subscribe to all of the Coin 6 podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.